Hi there, and welcome to A Different Way of Seeing. Have you ever wondered how a disabled person lives their life? Join our host, Lois Drachen, as she chats to people about work, education, travel, sport, the arts, and leisure, and the tools and techniques they use to live their lives with the disability. And now, on with the show.
Hi there, it's Lois. If you're a person with a disability who's wanting to achieve a goal and is looking for some help to get there, then maybe I'm the person you need to talk to. Listen after the interview and find out more details of how I can help you to reach your goals and dreams. Thanks today to Hindenburg Pro for assisting us in producing the show. That's Hindenburg.com. Hindenburg, it's all about the story. Hi there, and welcome to today's episode of A Different Way of Seeing, a podcast where we talk all things disability. I'm your host, Lois Drachen. Today, we are chatting with Dr. Julie Seemers, who is joining us from America. And Julie is a specialist in the concept of patient safety. And we're going to be looking in more detail at that topic generally, and then looking specifically at how it applies to those of us who are living a day-to-day existence with a chronic condition or a disability. Julie, thank you so much for joining us on the show. It is great to have you with us.
Thank you. I feel honored to be here and speak with your audience.
Well, we look forward to hearing what you have to say. Anyone who's listened to my show knows that the first place that I usually start, because I generally know a little about my guests before I bring them onto the show, but many of my audience may not. So, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and your background?
Sure. So I've been a nurse for 46 years now, which seems really crazy to say that. I started into nursing school right out of high school. And for the first 30 years of my career, worked at the bedside, ICU, the trauma department, emergency. I was a flight nurse for 10 years on the helicopter. Oh, wow. So that was fun. Yeah. And then I entered nursing education back in 2009. And that's where my eyes were opened to a little bit different world of nursing, teaching, you know, the basics. And I started on my master's degree because I wanted to teach in the classroom, not just in the hospital or the simulation. And then my doctoral degree. And in that research, my topic was failure to rescue, which is not something I made up. It is in the literature, but a lot of healthcare providers or nurses even don't understand what that is. And it really is just a nurse missing the signs of a patient becoming unstable. And we say the nurses because they're at the bedside, at least here in America, for 12 hours with the patient, and the doctor's only in there just a few minutes. And so that really opened my eyes in that research to discovering how much patient harm was happening. And I was shocked because me being in the profession never knew that. We don't discuss it. It's like, I call it the Wizard of Oz curtain of healthcare. You know, what's behind there, which was surprising. So it became this passion I didn't know I had inside me to help make it a safer place. And I started with the patient side and wrote my book a couple of years ago, Surviving Your Hospital Stay, because I think for the general population, the healthcare environment is like a foreign country. It's a different language, right? It's a different flow. It's who's this doctor? What are they supposed to do? It's very confusing. And I felt like if the patients understood more, they could ask better questions. Mm-hmm. and not be a passive recipient of healthcare. My goal is to inform, educate, and empower patients to speak up. And to do that, you have to have a little bit of background knowledge, at least about yourself.
Yeah, I mean, when it comes down to it, as a patient, it is our life and yes, our health. And I hear what you're saying about patient passivity. And I've seen that in my own kind of life experience of being in and out of the medical system as a patient and in the various treatments and conditions that I've lived with, that many people just lie there and expect to be told what they need to know. They expect that the experts are looking out for them. And yet the medical staff, the nursing staff are only human beings as well. So, yeah, it's quite a complex thing when one really thinks about it.
You're right. And I don't believe that there's very few that go into the profession with an intention to let harm occur to a patient.
Yeah.
Right. But I think the other, right. You know, there's a, you know, a couple that have made the news over the years. They're just a little psychotic or whatever, but for the most part, when mistakes happen, medical errors, or even what they call negligence, medical malpractice, in all the research I've done, yes, a human makes a mistake, a nurse giving the wrong medication, a doctor misdiagnosing, whatever. But for the majority, it is systems errors that allow a human error. And the biggest problem I see in healthcare is we're not transparent. It's like we keep our secrets and we sweep them under the rug or put them in a box and put them on a high shelf nobody will see. And that really defeats the ability for any of us to learn from someone else's mistakes, you know, even if it's unintentional, it just happens to be, I'll give you an example. When Dennis Quaid, the actor, had his twins that were premature, and it was quite a while ago, but it's a really good example. They were in the NICU and they needed heparin, which is a blood thinner. Well, yeah, the two bottles of heparin, one is one in 10,000 and one is one in 1,000. So a very different dose, but the label looked the same. And so you can imagine a nurse quickly looking at a bottle and missing one of the zeros, and they were overdosed and luckily did not die. But, you know, Dennis had to go before a hearing and to demand that the pharmaceutical company change the label so this doesn't happen to others. I would think the moral integrity would be, oh my goodness, I can't believe that. Let's go ahead and change the label rather than having to be made to do it. And of course, it's going to cost, you know, hundreds of thousands, maybe millions of dollars. But what's the cost of life, right?
Yes. Yeah, that is so true. And as you say, that's a very good example to indicate how a system failure can result in human error that can result in patient harm. So, yeah, but as we've already said, it becomes a very complicated, a complex question to unpack. And hopefully we're going to do that a little bit during the conversation. So let's start off with looking at the greatest, what you see as the greatest risks faced by patients. You've already mentioned the patient passivity, but what other challenges do you feel are the major players in this whole conversation?
There is an agency here in the U.S. called the Joint Commission. And they are responsible for kind of all things patient safety, especially acute care settings and hospitals. And they have said for several years that 70% of patient harm is due to communication breakdown. So that is communication between healthcare providers themselves, doctor to doctor, doctor to nurse, or even patients' families. And so I say our responsibility as family members is to speak up, which I know is difficult sometimes, mm-hmm. especially believing the culture of this hierarchy. But if we say, hey, my mom is not normally acting like this, even though she's 75 years old, she is not confused. Something is going on. Yeah. Now, hopefully the healthcare team, the nurse, the doctors will say, oh, we just thought she was in a nursing home and just assumed 75, she would be normally confused. Let's dig into it and figure out what's going on. That's what should happen. But unfortunately, if the nurse says, oh, she's fine, she's been like this, I'll keep an eye on her, or we do the medical gaslighting, unfortunately, or if we don't pay attention and listen, we can really miss some cues, those cues that tell us the patient is becoming clinically unstable.
Yeah.
Now, in all my research, I found, which also I thought was surprising, but it makes sense, those physiological changes happen 6 to 24 hours before an unplanned cardiac arrest.
Interesting.
So to me, that's plenty of time. Yeah. I think it's just they're not tuned into really counting the respiratory rate or acknowledging the heart rate is faster than it was a couple of hours ago, which also indicates, you know, that something's going on with the body. We're trying to compensate for not enough oxygen or something. And so, you know, I find that a lot of times they just don't take the time to really, what are these clues telling us? I tell my nursing students, they're like Sherlock Holmes. They're an investigator.
And at the same time, bearing in mind that, as you say, these are patients who may not be familiar to the nursing staff, so they don't really have a benchmark, an accurate benchmark against which to assess the condition, not to mention that being in a medical environment and a medical venue, or a hospital or something like that, or in a clinic, that does place extra stress on a body. There is anxiety. There are all sorts of other reasons that may be coming into play. So I can understand, again, I'm going back to that word, complexity. So it's a really interesting conversation.
Yes, for sure. I think one of the tips I would love to share with your audience, mm-hmm. it still ties into communication, is taking a notebook and really documenting every time you visit the doctor, what they say, because that gives you the ability, again, to direct your own healthcare. Yeah. When you may sometimes say, oh, well, this physician, maybe my cardiologist told me this, and now your nephrologist or your endocrinologist, some of the other specialties, they don't always communicate and they're not always on the same page with each other. And you can have some doctors writing prescriptions that maybe shouldn't be giving together with another prescription, which hopefully the pharmacist will identify that and intervene. But again, this is where I think an active role in your own healthcare to become informed about your disease or your illness and your medications is so essential for you to direct what's going on with your healthcare and not assume that somebody else is going to see the big picture because they miss pieces quite frequently. Yeah.
And obviously, if you know you're in a hospital setting or in a receiving medical care for a particular acute condition, that might not take other chronic or other conditions that you're living with into consideration. I mean, I'm just looking at my own situation. I'm blind. I'm diabetic, type 1. I'm on dialysis. I'm hypertensive. I mean, I have quite a list of things to take into consideration. Yeah. Whenever I go into a hospital or a medical setting, I have with me a list of all of my medications and the dosage that I'm receiving. I have around my neck a pendant which has my basic conditions, my blindness, my diabetes, my dialysis, plus it has on it my allergies. And it's just a way of saying, if people need that information, if I am not in a position to represent my own needs, to advocate for my own needs, which typically I am, and I tend to be a fairly vocal patient, as any of my medical team will tell you, that I will put that position, piece of paper in front of them and say, you want to give me a new medication? How is it going to engage and interact with the other medications I'm on? Because I don't want to experience problems. I've had enough problems in my life to, So I try to make certain that I am prepared and protected against that kind of thing. I want to go back to something that you said a few minutes ago, though. Medical gaslighting. Now, I think I have an idea of what that term means, but can you explain it just so that I'm sure?
Yes, I'll give you an example. I was on a webinar with patient safety leaders a couple of months ago, and one of the women who's been very actively involved in America in, and probably, you know, across Europe as well, in actively advocating for patient safety, because she's had two of her own very, egregious mistakes that happened with her family members. One with her son when he was born, they missed his elevated bilirubin and he ended up with brain damage and he's now got cerebral palsy. Well, when he was four, her husband, they found a brain tumor and went through the surgery. The physician said, hey, don't worry about it. It looked like it was benign. Well, when the pathology came back and was not benign, it had cancerous cells. It got misfiled. And so she lost her husband 6 months later. Because of that mistake. That's a diagnostic error, which again is one of the common problems that happen in healthcare. You wouldn't think, but it's about 33% of all patients in the emergency department end up, and at least in America, having a misdiagnosis or a delayed diagnosis of some sorts. But this woman, it's been several years since her husband died, and she's remarried to a doctor, in fact. And she was telling him, you know, my tooth, my jaw, my ear, that side of my face has been aching for days. And he said, you know, like 3 or 4 days. And he looked at her and he said, well, your face is drooping. You know, it's got some, you know, so she went to the emergency department. They ruled out a stroke. They ruled out a brain tumor and then said, you know, you're histrionics. Like you're exaggerating what's going on here. Go home and take some Tylenol. Well, she knew, you know, our body tells us when something's not right. And this is again where I implore healthcare providers and healthcare practitioners to listen. But she went home and even her husband said, yeah, I think you have Bell's palsy. They went on to ChatGPT. And I know there's been some, you know, a lot of people say, oh, I'm not sure about AI. It's going to give me erroneous information. But this woman and her husband went on to ChatGPT and they said, yeah, those are symptoms of Bell's palsy. So she went to another emergency department that afternoon and this doctor listened and she was right. He confirmed the diagnosis. And the important thing is with Bell's palsy, one of the first medications that they should get is a steroid. So which takes down the inflammation. And had she waited longer, she would have never recovered the facial muscles in her face. She would have had a permanent droop. It's been a while and she still has a little bit of a droop. But again, there are consequences for, you know, so the first doctor medically gaslighted her by saying, oh, quit exaggerating and minimizing her symptoms and not really digging in to take her concerns seriously.
Yeah. And I have heard so many stories of that particular challenge being faced by people with chronic conditions and with disabilities who are kind of, and I'm going to say this, it's going to be very rude, but I'm going to say patted on the head and told, yes, 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 you're fine, go away now. When in fact, there is a very real issue that is not being diagnosed. Mm-hmm. So I get it. The medical profession is doing the best that they can with the tools and the resources that they have available. But when it comes down to it, we do know our bodies best as human beings. And if there's something that we know is wrong, there's at least a good chance that this is something happening there.
Yes.
So looking then at what you've been saying about some of the challenges, misdiagnoses, the mistreatment, errors in the system, things like that, what do you think the root causes of those challenges are?
At least in America, doctors here, when they see a patient in their office, usually have about 6 to 8 minutes with the patient.
Wow.
Because they're booked so tight because of insurance reimbursements and mm-hmm. all sorts of laws in our system here that they're too fast. They don't take the time to listen because they're just in a hurry. And I think that's a really big problem.
Yeah.
And so another part of that, I think, is nurses in America aren't as ready for practice and safe and don't know how to use clinical judgment like they did when they came out of school 10 or 20 years ago. So we're not doing a very good job in nursing education, preparing them for practice. When I got out of school years ago and were taking care of patients on the medical surgical unit, they weren't nearly as ill or sick or complex as they are today. And, you know, I had a hard time sometimes keeping up with the medications, the blood transfusions, the, you know, blood sugar checks, the admissions, the discharges. I mean, all those things. It's always been busy. But now it's almost like they don't even have the time to stop and do the appropriate assessment to get a baseline. Like we were talking about that earlier. If you miss the baseline assessment, how are you going to know? And this is always what I teach my students, but also my patients and their families.
Yeah.
If we think of a continuum, and one end of the continuum, the patient's healthy, we don't have very many healthy patients. And the other end of the spectrum or the continuum, the patient's dead. So every patient, especially in the acute care setting, is somewhere on that continuum.
Yes.
If they're outside of the acute care setting, we usually have a little bit more flexible timeline. It's not usually as urgent. But the nurse's job is to say, pull those pieces of data together. We call it clinical judgment and say, whoa, wait a second here. I have an increased respiratory rate, or the patient does. Their heart rate is increasing and their blood pressure's falling. Something is definitely wrong. Getting more data, call in the rapid response team or call in the physician. But those things don't happen soon enough. And so the patient continues to deteriorate. So that's one piece of it. I do want to go back to what you talked about just a minute ago and add this for the audience is how to speak up, whether you're in the acute care setting or in the, just the healthcare setting, the medical clinics or whatever, is if you feel you're getting blown off or patted on the head, and I think that's such a great visual, then use your cuss words. And those words, I talk about this in my TEDx talk that I came out in January, again, to get the attention of the healthcare team, whether it's the doctor or the nurse. I'm concerned, I'm uncomfortable, I'm scared, or this is a safety issue. And those are supposed to be flag words that say, maybe we better do a little bit more investigating to see what's going on here. And I also say on top of that is escalate. If you tell the nurse, hey, my husband doesn't look right. I don't know what it is, but something is wrong. And if you, you know, don't see any action or intervention, escalate. So here in the US, then we have a charge nurse. Then we have the house supervisor, which is over all of nursing. And then we have the administrative office, the C-suite, the chief academic officer, the chief nursing officer, all those. But there is always an administrator on call on the nights and weekends. So those are avenues that you just don't sit back and say, oh, I guess I don't really know anything. I don't have a medical degree. Follow your gut intuition and keep escalating, especially if you say, okay, well, I'm looking at the monitor. Their heart rate was 100 an hour ago when I told you something is wrong. Now it's 110. I know that's not right. Try to get some action.
Do you find that in the work that you've done, particularly when you were working directly with patients, that in the medical profession, there is a tendency for the medical professionals to claim an expert status and to resist being questioned?
Yes, unfortunately. Part of that, I believe, might be embarrassment or guilt or shame that they think they should know all the answers and they don't. I've heard when I was with students in the hospitals, I've heard nurses give explanations to patients that were incorrect. and how are we going to know, right? As the lay people, how are we going to know that that's not correct unless we look it up ourselves? And I don't use Google or don't suggest Google only because you can get a wide variety of answers.
Yeah.
But yeah, you know, I always tell my students the only answer, the only question that is a dumb question is the one you don't ask.
Yeah.
And, you know, I've had patients that we were taking care of that had complexities going on, and the student, there was a procedure we were going to do in the afternoon called a pleuridesis, and he said, well, what's that? And I said, oh gosh, I haven't done one in a while and it's kind of hazy in my mind and I can't remember. Let's go look it up together. Mm-hmm. And then I was like, oh yeah, of course, that's what it is and why, and here's what we're going to do. But I think that's, that humility is really important for a doctor to even say to their patients, you know, I'm not the expert in this, or I'm not up on the latest research. Let's discover this together and then determine what is the best route for you. Because as I always say, you're the captain of your ship. You said that too in your way. It's your body. It's your life. You get to decide,
yeah,
you know, the course of, are we going to do dialysis or not? And here's what it looks like, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm also just want to go back to the statement that you made that in most cases, doctors only have between 6 and 8 minutes with a patient. If nurses as well are working 12-hour shifts, can we talk a bit about fatigue? How does that play a role?
It's real. Yeah, it is real. When the U.S. adopted electronic health records, they were supposed to make the job easier,
yeah,
and prevent mistakes. Well, it does prevent mistakes on one hand because there's cross-referencing for medications. But the other problem is there is what we call alert fatigue. So there'll be hundreds of alerts that you can't keep up with. And so the clinician, whether it be the physician, the nurse, the pharmacist, whatever, will hit override and ignore, because I don't know the percentage, but let's just say 90% of the alerts are garbage. I mean, they're not really relevant.
Yeah.
But then it really sets us up for failure or to make mistakes, because those alerts that are critical may get ignored. So I think that's a piece of it too.
Yeah, I can imagine.
I think you had something to say.
No, just thinking about, you know, sitting in a hospital ward with five or six people, each with different electronic devices measuring and monitoring their conditions. And there are constantly noise alerts going off. And it's often a barrage of sound that
it is
must be totally overwhelming for
the
medical team.
They get desensitized to it.
Yeah.
Just like in the ICU, for example, there's so many machines that beep, alarm, the telephones, the, you know, all those noises. So that, yeah, is another problem. Alert fatigue as well as alarm fatigue. The other thing with nurses and fatigue, at least here in the US, a lot of them will work extra shifts.
Yes.
Because of short staffing, pardon me, or someone calling in sick. And a normal shift of 12 hours, it's hard. Keep alert and on your game. But there's some that'll extend to work 16 hours. Some are working, you know, three shifts are considered full time. So that's 36 hours, but that leaves you 4 days a week. And so many of them will pick up an extra shift or two to help out their colleagues, and they don't want to leave their patients at risk, you know. But I'll say something else too, is I think the moral distress and the ethical dilemmas in healthcare also play a factor in fatigue, psychological fatigue. And so the combination of those two things can be really exhausting and cause that burnout.
Tell us what you mean about that, the moral fatigue, the...
Yeah, so ethical? For example, when I was still working in the ICU, we had an 88-year-old who was not mentally with it. Mm-hmm. I can't remember the complexity of his diseases, but heart failure and, you know, several other chronic diseases, and his kidneys were shutting down, and the doctors wanted to dialyze this patient. Mm-hmm. And my heart says, are we giving good care for quality of life? And I did not see that extending this little frail 88-year-old man who had no family to speak up for him to say enough is enough. Why would we dialyze him? And maybe they wouldn't in other countries. And to me, that was a moral distress. And to me, an ethical dilemma, really on the same vein, because if he could speak up, would he agree to this? I highly doubt it.
Yes, being placed in a position where you have to face decisions like that, I can understand the pressure that that places on one as a medical professional. Because, your duty is to preserve life and health.
Yeah.
But sometimes, the tough decisions.
Yeah. So,
as patients... and as family of patients, what are some of the things that we can do to protect our safety?
I think the biggest thing you can do is be actively engaged, like we talked about earlier. But for example, if your husband's in the hospital and you're sitting at the bedside and the nurse comes in to give a medication, you ask, what is this medication you're giving? What is this supposed to do? And what are we going to watch for? Because medications, I think, have some kind of side effects, even the ones over the counter. And it really is becoming informed and asking, you know, and if the medical team's going to get defensive or shut you out, I don't think that's a good enough reason to stop advocating and stop asking questions. Because in my TEDx talk, I gave three patient examples that were real stories and heartbreaking. You know, and even in these three stories, the family spoke up and said, the mom with Lewis Blackman, sad story, he was 15 years old. She said, something is wrong with my son. And because he had no other comorbidities, no other diseases, he just had surgery on his chest to fix a congenital deformity. You know, the healthcare team had this cognitive bias that he was fine. And mom was a little, you know, blowing things out of proportion. And because he has this resilience of being 15 years old and a pretty healthy body, he lasted for 4 days until he died. So there was plenty of opportunity for the healthcare team to really listen and intervene. And so I always say, if you feel scared to speak up, you have to think about what may be the consequences if I don't speak up. And I'm not going to assume that every patient that, you know, you feel uncomfortable about is going to have a bad outcome. But what is the worst that can happen is they can, you know, shut you down or pat you on the head or give you false assurance. Mm-hmm. But you just have to keep pushing, especially if you're just really uncomfortable or concerned or scared.
You know, for myself, I know that sometimes my doctors may get a little frustrated with me and my medical teams may, but I am going to insist on getting an answer to my questions and keep insisting until I understand what they are saying, what has caused them to feel that is the best way forward, and what the consequences are going to be. And yes, I know that sometimes the doctors are pushed. Well, often the doctors are pushed for time. I know the nursing staff are pushed for time. But if I do not get an answer, I'm not going ahead with the procedure. I will not take a medication until that's been explained to me. Because I don't want to have to deal with the consequences. And over and above that, I don't want to cause extra pressure on a medical staff that is already very, very pressurized. Because if I have something happening that is suddenly an emergency, that causes extra stress for them as well. So let me rather take the time to understand what's happening and why, and hopefully we'll all benefit in the end.
Yeah, I did a little social media post the other day because I came across this Ask Me Three, and I thought I shared it with my community.
Yeah.
But it's great. These three questions: what is my main problem? What do I need to do? And why is it important for me to do this? Mm-hmm. And so when we break it down with the clarity of, you know, what's my main problem and what do I need to do? And then tell me why. I think that gives, again, the healthcare provider the understanding that the patient and their family really want to be engaged. You know, and I think, again, what I strive to do in my work is create that bridge between the consumer, which is the patient and their families, and the healthcare team, of back and forth and open communication and partnership. And I think that is the only way that we're really going to make a change and make a difference in outcomes. Patient outcomes.
I was also just thinking back to what you were saying earlier about the important role that accurate communication plays, and thinking about, well, pretty much every country in the world now is incredibly, wonderfully diverse. But when we're dealing with multicultural, multilingual, you know, that is the reality of a medical setting. Communication is even more complicated in that situation, isn't it?
Yeah, it truly is.
So, yeah, just bringing that into the mix as well. So, Julie, I want to just ask you, what tools or resources do you feel would be useful for patients as a way of growing in awareness and protecting themselves more accurately? And I'd particularly like you to chat a little bit here about your own book and your own work, but as a starting point, and then maybe suggest some other resources that you might know of.
Sure. I think, and that's why I love to come on and talk about these things, because we assume healthcare is safe. And I believe with my heart that we have to flip that with a healthy skepticism. So just not go in with blind faith that, you know, we're going to walk out healed, and hopefully that happens. But enough times that it doesn't, that we need to prepare ourselves and arm ourselves. And so that's why I wrote the book a couple years ago, Surviving Your Hospital Stay. And I broke it down into 19 chapters, how to pick your hospital. At least here in the US, there is a website that ranks the hospitals from A to F, just like college papers. You know, you failed or you got a D or a B. And they take 22 safety categories of the hospital. It's a nonprofit organization, so completely unbiased. And they twice a year will update the reports on how safe these hospitals are. So here in the US, you can go on to hospitalsafetygrade.org and put in your zip code. And you can see all the hospitals in your area. And you can see, oh, that one's an F. Not too many are F, thank goodness, but there's enough. D's aren't great either. I would definitely try to go in A or B hospital. But then you can also drill down and look at the categories. And you can see in the category of surgery, where does this hospital rank in these six subcategories? And it's easy. You don't have to have a medical degree to understand it because it's red, yellow, green. So for example, in infections, how does this hospital do with MRSA or C. difficile or, you know, that type of thing? Or how does this hospital do postoperatively with preventing patient blood clots? So that's, you know, the type of information I tried to include in my book that was practical and applicable to whatever you're looking for to understand better. It is slanted towards the acute care setting because that's where most of my experience and education in, revolves around. And again, I think it's the most acute area for patients and their families to understand. But I also started my social media channels last year just to give not a lot of people. I mean, some people don't like to read, you know, but I, again, like to go on podcasts and share. But on my social media channels, I try to talk about relevant. Sometimes it's a public service announcement. For example, what I read in the medical news, there was a 12-year-old boy swimming in a lake here in South Carolina that ended up getting an amoeba in his brain and died. And so I just, hey, everyone, if you're swimming in warm water, you know, make sure your children plug their nose when they jump in the water, just, you know, things like that. So, yeah, anything that might be of interest health-wise, safety-wise. And then I created nursing courses because of the gaps of practice readiness for nurses. And I've got those on my website that hospitals can go to and look at and purchase for their nurses. But I'm really excited. Since I spoke with you last, I'm developing an app for patients and their families.
Ooh, tell us a little bit
more. Yeah. So I'm going to model it on my book chapters, because I felt after, you know, thinking about it for a long time and what is really relevant. For example, there'll be surgery. Make sure that the informed consent that you sign has the correct body site. You know, make sure it says the left leg if that's what you're going to have your knee replaced, because unfortunately, the wrong site surgeries still occur, which is crazy to me. But again, how can you be proactive, not to scare people, but to really, you know, raise the awareness that this could happen, but here's how you can be proactive in helping prevent that. So yeah, I don't think it's going to take that long. I will definitely email you and let you know, when it's ready. But I really wanted somewhere where patients could go and just say, hey, I'm having surgery. What do I need to do? Mm-hmm. Or my dad's in the ICU. Help me understand what it means he's on the ventilator, you know, and a community where people can interact with each other.
And will that be applicable in a global setting or will it be US specific?
It definitely will be global. I think it's really easy to switch to your own language. I'll try to make it global application, but again, I don't know how Germany or England operates in variety of, you know, or variations of what the US does. So some things, well, like the hospital safety grade is not applicable everywhere, yeah. But I wonder, and I'll have to research this. Thank you for that. Are there places in South Africa or England or Germany where you can look and see, you know, the ratings, safety ratings of hospitals? That's a really good question.
And I wouldn't know even for my own country. So it's a really fascinating one for, you know, a patient to take into consideration. How do you assess the level of excellence at a particular hospital? Yeah. Because that can be crucial. And yes. I do understand that, you know, for many people, they don't have much option in which hospital they are able to go to. You know, there's a lot of poverty, there's a lot of lack of infrastructure, lack of transport and things like that, and lack of public transport. But still, if you do have a choice, how do you ensure your safety by ensuring that you are getting the best care that you can?
Yeah.
So, you know, that kind of thing I think is very important. And I think your book, while it is perhaps more directly useful in an American context, will have a lot of information that will be globally relevant for the types of questions that a patient should and could be asking, for the types of measures that they could be taking to ensure that they are not placed at medical risk, and yeah, just really protecting their own health, their own lives themselves.
So. Yeah, I think a lot of it crosses over, like the chapter on vital signs. I mean, the mm-hmm. human body is the human body, right?
Yeah. Yeah, that's very, very true. So we will definitely share the link to the book in the episode description, as well as any other resources that you feel might be of use to the people listening.
You bet.
So, if people would like to find out more about you and your work, how can they do so? Have you got any online resources or social media links that you can share with us?
You bet. Most everything is Dr. Julie Siemers. That's Siemers. That's my website. I've got a free patient safety checklist on the website. The link for my book is also there. I have blogs or articles that I've written about, for example, sometimes I dive deep into respiratory rate, and I chose that one in the vital signs because it is the most sensitive and earliest indicator of patient deterioration.
Interesting.
But yet the research found that only 80% of nurses don't count the respiration. They write down a number, which isn't always accurate. And so they miss that early sign. And I think it's a lack of knowledge. You know, I was never taught that information. I did not know. I mean, physiologically, it makes sense. Mm-hmm. If the cells are starving for oxygen for whatever reason, whether it's the beginning of infection or sepsis or, you know, hypovolemia, let's just say there's an internal bleed going on and there's not enough blood circulating. Yeah, our respiratory rate, thankfully, we compensate. Our body's autonomic nervous system will say, hey, we need some more oxygen or red blood cells, and speeds up their, you know, respiratory cycle without us even thinking about it. So when I understand those things and then I can teach it to the students and nurses that I, you know, educate too, I think that's going to help. But even the layperson, if they see, hey, dad's breathing a little funny, and they get out there, you know, watch and say, hey, you know, look on the app or whatever. When that comes out, respiratory rate is normal up to 20 breaths a minute for an adult. And dad's been breathing 24, 26 breaths a minute for the last hour. Something's going on.
It's interesting because it kind of makes me reevaluate the stress that at my dialysis center, that the medical team places on. If you see any difference in your breathing, if you experience mm-hmm. any difficulty in breathing, let us know immediately. So
yeah.
There at least is one place that, yeah, that is how it can be.
Is doing it right?
Yeah. I'll tell them that it was a good sign, and they must keep on doing that.
Yes.
Great. So just to clarify, the website then is drjulieseemers.com.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Great. Thank you. That's super. So what would you say then is the one single most important thing for people to do before undergoing medical care?
Gosh, that's hard to break it down to one, but I think awareness is super important.
Mm-hmm.
Being informed about your own body, your diseases, your illness, what's going on, document it, write it down. If it's been something that's been going on for 3 days and it's getting worse, well, it started on this day and this is what's happened. So journal about it, make sure you know your medications, and speak up when you feel like something is just not quite right. Because that is going to, again, the more of us, and put myself in that patient category, mm-hmm. the more of us that become informed and ask questions and really have the true desire to partner with our healthcare team, I think that's going to have to change the culture of how we do it now, which in a lot of places is just not healthy because it's one-sided, right? Or one way.
Yeah. So I think what I'm taking out of our conversation today is very much the importance of speaking up, speaking out, and asking questions, the importance of communication, accurate communication that is given and understood. That, you know, that seems to be one of the most important ways that we can, as patients, and particularly patients with disabilities, that we can ensure our safety when engaging with the medical profession.
Yes, well said. That was a good recap.
Thank you. So, Dr. Julie Seemers, thank you so much for joining us this evening or today on A Different Way of Seeing. It has been fascinating to chat to you. I've learned so much in the last 45 minutes or so. And I really appreciate your willingness to share the information and to help us as patients and as people to make sure that when we go into a medical setting and engage with a medical team, that we do get the best care possible and the safest care possible. I really appreciate your willingness to share your insights on that.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
It's been a real pleasure. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Hi, it's Lois again. I'm not certain if you know, but I am a coach who works specifically with people with disabilities. If you have a disability and are wanting to achieve your goals, or maybe think through some of the challenges that you're facing in your professional or personal life, or want to take up a new opportunity, a new adventure, but just don't seem to be able to get to doing it, let's explore how I can help you. Hop onto the Contact Me form on my website, www.loisstrachan.com. That's Loisstrachan, LOISSTRACHAN.com. And sign up for a 30-minute discovery call so we can chat to see if I am the right person to help you to achieve your goals. Contact me now for that free 30-minute discovery call on loisstrachan.com. I'd love to have the opportunity of helping you to achieve your goals.
Thank you for listening to A Different Way of Seeing. We would love to connect with you, so find Lois at loisstrachan.com or Facebook, Lois Strachan Speaker. This podcast was edited by Craig Strachan using Hindenburg Pro. Hindenburg, it's all about the story. The credits are done at Naledi Media. Naledi Media, all your vocal needs under one roof. Read by Charlie Jassy. That's it for now. Thank you for joining us and see you next time when we bring you into the world of seeing differently.